everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the show all about audiobooks recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios. I'm your host, Red Sail, and today we're manning the boats and taking to the sea. Historian David Gange takes us on a journey of discovery around the frayed Atlantic edge of Britain and Ireland.
This kind of feels like an adventure, crossing these bits of rough sea in a little boat. But these are things that every family on these coastlines, every family with their own boat, used to do all the time.
Adventurer Mick Dawson recalls the highs and lows he experienced when rowing across the Pacific.
Pacific is definitely not the word that would correctly describe that stretch of ocean most of the time.
And coastal dweller Joanna Streatley discusses her wild, fierce life in and beside the sea.
It's about times when things really just went wrong. So a lot of people write about their adventures. These tend to be sort of misadventures when I wasn't really planning to have an adventure that day.
That's all coming up in today's Read On. A new addition to the RNIB library is The Frayed Atlantic Edge by historian and nature writer David Gange. The book charts his year-long exploration of the Atlantic coasts of Britain and Ireland. Sitting at sea level in his kayak, he had the same perspective as those who for thousands of years lived and traded in these areas. He set out to understand their history and to see what it meant for our future. But he joined me on dry land at the Camden Studios to tell me all about it. David Gange, welcome to Read On.
Thank you so much for having me. Hello.
Now, you're a cultural historian, and there's a lovely thing that you say at the beginning of the book. You're resetting the balance of the geographical diversity of history of Britain, which is what really led you to the western coast of Britain, the Atlantic coast.
Yes, absolutely. So it was only really in the 19th century that the middle of Britain and the middle of Ireland, where the kind of big roads and rail links go, became the centres. Until that point, lots of trade, lots of travel, lots of culture had happened along the coastlines instead. And I wanted to come up with a way of viewing Britain that turned things that way. And I realised if I was to kayak down all of the coastlines from Shetland down to the Channel that were Atlantic, I'd be giving a version of Britain where, for most of the journey, English is the second language, where I could travel for five whole months of the year passing only one town of more than 600 people, and where, as you say, I could just look back into how the geography of the islands looked before that industrial revolution turnaround happened.
Yeah, we are very much a post-industrial revolution society where history is urban, and we've forgotten, I suppose, the trading links that we had with all of Western Europe and Scandinavia and, well, the Iberian Peninsula. We look inwards rather than outwards now.
Yes, absolutely. So there are sites in Ireland, for instance, where if you look through the archaeology of the coastal site, you find lots and lots of evidence of links with China for centuries before you find a single bit of evidence for a link with London, which is quite extraordinary.
And you found a very rich set of archives of that local history as you were travelling along and in your research beforehand. These aren't dead cultures, although they might appear to be so from some of the more recent history.
Absolutely, that is completely the case. So between about 1800 and about 1970, most kind of technological developments worked against these places, made them marginal, made them more difficult to get to, more difficult to work from. But since the 1970s, all the technological developments to do with the internet and things have kind of made life easier, have relinked those places into bigger networks and have created a huge revival. So there's lots and lots of interest in the history of these regions, lots of spectacular archives. I mean, the archive for Shetland, for instance, which has a population of about 20,000, is far better staffed, far better organised than the archive for the whole of Birmingham. It's quite astonishing.
And they are so interlinked. I hadn't really appreciated how linked Shetland was to the other coastal trading settlements of, well, stretching for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles.
Yes, partly because of unpredictabilities of sea travel. If you try and head round Cape Wrath in the northwest of Scotland in a small boat to get to the Western Isles like Lewis and Harris, there's a reasonably high chance you'll be blown off course and end up in Orkney or Shetland. So the interchange was constant. The interchange is constant again now. We just have that kind of dark age, the 19th and 20th centuries, when it wasn't.
I love the fact that those are the dark ages, whereas actually the dark ages that we learn about at school are actually a very vibrant time.
Completely. That's the thing about seeing the British and Irish islands from that perspective, is you have to overturn all those narratives. The Enlightenment was a total disaster for these regions, whereas, like you say, they had their Enlightenment several centuries before in what were the dark ages. Much of Europe.
Now, clearly it was very important for you to explore every inch of this very dramatic frayed coastline in the same way as those traders did for hundreds and maybe thousands of years. It was also extremely dangerous at times. You were in an 18-foot kayak for most of the time?
Yeah, I mean, the important thing to remember with this is that this kind of feels like an adventure, crossing these bits of rough sea in a little boat. But these are things that every family on these coastlines, every family with their own boat, used to do all the time. And it's another indication of how things have been turned around, that this thing that would have seemed totally alien and impossible to them, that we can communicate with people on the other side of the globe in an instant, seems totally ordinary to us. Yet something that was completely ordinary to all of them, crossing these bits of sea, is now kind of alien and feels like an adventure to us. So the little boat is a way of being able to empathise with those people in the past, being able to understand the world from their perspective.
And I was fascinated, actually, to find out that your kayak, yes, it might be made out of more modern materials, but actually it is pretty much the same kind of design as would have been used maybe 2,000 years ago.
In terms of its shape and things like that, then very much there's a long, long tradition of these kind of kayaks and small boats, lots of traditions of them all around the Atlantic.
Now, for anybody who hasn't read the book already, and I do urge them to, I am absolutely hooked. What were some of the scarier moments?
So I almost gave up on the first day. So I was coming out of the north of Shetland to this tiny little rock, which is the northernmost part of the British Isles, called Outstack. And it was a beautiful, sunny, calm day. Couldn't have been any better. I thought it wasn't going to be all that momentous. Kayaked up the Firth, suddenly had hundreds of thousands of gannets circling overhead, to the point where I couldn't hear the sea anymore. And hearing is possibly the most important navigational thing for a kayaker. You're listening to where the waves are breaking ahead of you. That's how you know where there is a reef or something like that. And you're listening for these corridors of silence that you can pursue, because that's where safety lies. So all these gannets overhead, making me feel a bit perturbed anyway, and then I hit this huge wall of tides. Just waves pushing the bow of the kayak under the water until it kind of surged up from its buoyancy, just beating me around, and I had to roll the kayak. I was knocked underwater by waves twice, and just felt, within about an hour of setting off, like I'd been through a huge washing machine, and stopped on a little bay, in a little island, a little bay, and had to think very, very hard about whether I'd bitten off more than I could chew, whether this was the end of my journey. Then there was a point later on where I'd sat in my kayak watching minke whales for a while, and I'd been noticing how their habit was to rise two or three times to breathe and then plunge down for 5 minutes. And I'd seen that the distance between one rise and the next was about 40 feet. And then out the corner of my eye, I saw a fin rise 40 feet behind me and realized that it was going to rise exactly where my kayak was if it followed the pattern I'd been watching. So I held onto my paddle with one hand, realizing if it did rise underneath me, there was nothing I could do, paddle in hand or not. I picked up my camera with the other, and it rose about 6 feet to my right. And I got one picture of the fin over the top of the water, and then just was sloshed sideways by all the water that had come off its back, and had to just brace myself against the sea to stay upright and didn't drop the camera to the bottom of the Atlantic.
You mentioned that there are beautiful photos, lovely maps, and rather a stunning dust jacket, I understand, which for a blind and partially sighted audience, could you describe some of the more visually beautiful aspect?
Okay, so one of my favourite things in the book is a little section break. Just between the different sections of the book, there is a beautiful little sea fan, which is a kind of seaweed, that someone I got in touch with up in Glasgow made for me. She presses seaweeds and makes art from them. So she made me this wonderful sea fan for Between the Sections. Then, yes, there are 12 maps, one for each of the sections of the journey. So Shetland, Orkney, the Western Isles, with the route marked carefully on them. And the map maker has been careful to show those kind of ragged, what we call fractals of the coastline that make it such a long coastline, even though the British Isles are so small. And then, yeah, the dust jacket shows lots of rough sea hitting what is probably a little island, with the title of the book written in a large beach in the middle of the page, with lighthouses. There's a dolphin rising above the water and lots of slightly stylized waves hitting rocks on the spine. And the one thing I asked for in particular, there's a little yellow kayak on the back showing me passing down the island.
And the visual beauty is more than matched by the linguistic beauty of your writing. It's a huge celebration of the Celtic languages and of the rich folkloric history that populates the Atlantic coasts. You have taught yourself a lot of those languages so that you'd be able to understand them better, haven't you?
So it's very kind of you to say all those things. My linguistic ability is very limited. I've been trying to learn Welsh for about 10 years, slowly moving along. Learning Gaelic better is my summer project this year. I'm not by any means a speaker of those languages, although I am incredibly interested in them, partly because they contain kinds of knowledge and kinds of wisdom that have been set in opposition to kind of urban, economically acquisitive culture for the last two centuries. And at the point now where people in cities, English-speaking cities, are beginning to realize how urgently we need to change some of our attitudes to the world, those slightly oppositional languages and cultures, they're an amazing resource for finding attitudes and outlooks on the world that fit better with the kind of ecological problems that we face today.
And it is absolutely beautifully read by Ed Hughes. And I was talking to the guys in the Talking Books studios earlier today because it was recorded here.
Okay, I didn't know that.
And I think both your publisher and presumably you went to great lengths to get somebody who would be able to get their tongue round all those wonderful words from so many different cultures.
Yes, and what a challenge that must have been for Ed. He was absolutely heroic to take it on, because there's so much poetry in there in things like the Shetland dialect, which is a profoundly rich language. I think of it as a language rather than a dialect, and I think the difference we draw between a language and a dialect is a political choice, not a technical one. And to find someone who was willing to read those dialect poems, it's absolutely extraordinary.
Well, I think he was reveling in it just as much as you were writing it, I think.
That's fantastic.
And there's a rather beautiful dedication at the beginning of the book. You were inspired to take to the sea in a kayak and to investigate Gaelic languages more by somebody who's been very special in your life.
Indeed, yes. So my partner through all of the book was Llinos Owen, who is a first language Welsh speaker and who had a car accident back in 2009, which has left her unable to walk very much. She was in a wheelchair for a year and her left leg, yeah, limits her walking each day. So the two of us took up kayaking together in 2010. And strangely, I've ended up kind of devoting a big part of my life to projects like this in the kayak. And she is now training with Team GB Paralympic kayak squad. So it turned out to be a far more momentous choice than we realised at the time when we bought our first little inflatable kayak in 2010.
And you didn't choose the easy way of doing this journey, which would have been to have gone from south to north and allowed the current to help you. You actually were going in the face of the current. Why?
Yeah, so it's the prevailing wind from the southwest that makes heading south to north so much more straightforward. Fortunately, it was the year of all of the last decade when those prevailing winds have been weakest and around least, so it didn't disadvantage me much. But it was really important to me to throw myself into the parts of the British Isles that are most different, the parts that are least well known right at the beginning, to head to Shetland and Orkney, to some really exciting kayaking and to some really, really profoundly distinctive cultures to begin with.
And had you just done the whistle stop tour, it would have been a lot shorter journey. How many miles extra did you add by investigating every inlet and cove and nook and cranny of the frayed Atlantic edge?
I think I added somewhere between about 800 and 1,000 miles by doing that.
As listeners will know, I'm a very keen rock climber, especially in coastal places.
And your adventures look spectacular on those sea stacks.
Well, you passed a fair few sea stacks along the way.
And climbed up only one.
Oh, which one?
So it was off the stags of Broadhaven, off County Mayo in Ireland. I took one of my favourite pictures I've ever taken from the top of the sea stack of Llenos kayaking underneath it.
What was your favourite moment on the entire trip?
That's a really difficult one. My favourite moments on the whole journey were often when the worst weather hit. And people imagine that when a storm hits and I'm doing one of these journeys, I'm there clinging to a rock or something. And in fact, that's never the case. I'm always drinking gallons and gallons of tea, someone on an island, like in their kitchen. So being stuck on somewhere like Bardsey Island through a week of storms, drinking tea with wonderful island people, often poets, and learning lots and lots of island histories in ways that could never happen otherwise, they were my absolute favourite moments, I think.
And I think that actually is the thing that really comes through the book. It is a real celebration of what we have in common as people rather than the differences. And the welcome that you seem to have received along the entire Atlantic coast of Britain and Ireland was unquestioning.
It was, strangely, given that I was out at sea in a little boat on my own for most of the year, it was the most social year I have ever had. And the generosity of people in the island places I passed through, particularly in Scotland and Ireland, was really quite unexpected to me. I thought people might consider me an intruder or someone just popping through who didn't really belong there. But no, the welcome was absolutely extraordinary. And I hope the book is a tribute to the people who live on those coastlines and the generosity of the cultures that they have.
You are now back on dry land and celebrating a very successful publication of the book. Are you tempted to get back out onto the waves again?
I get serious withdrawal symptoms whenever I don't. So I'm just back from 10 days in Shetland. I chose to launch the book in Shetland, partly because the people there had been so generous in helping me put everything together, partly because there are so many wonderful poets and musicians there that we could just have a really, really fun literary launch together. So I took the kayak out several days up there, took one of the poets out for a day as well on what was a surprisingly rough sea. And yes, I've got lots of kayak plans for future projects.
David Gange, thank you so much.
It's been such a pleasure. Thank you, Red.
This journey involved arriving, dripping and bedraggled in dozens of coastal communities. When I set out, I hadn't imagined just how generous the people whose homes and workplaces I dampened would be. Without such openness, particularly evident on small islands, this project would never have got far. I learned as much through long evenings of discussion as through the other three resources on which the book is based: libraries, archives, and the observation of land and sea from the kayak. It wasn't just the spectacles of sea cliffs, nor the dramas of ocean weather, but also those social occasions that meant I ended the journey with greatly intensified enthusiasm for scattered Atlantic islands like Fula, Barra, and Tory. Such conversations work to strengthen the conviction I set out with, that British and Irish histories are usually written inside out, perpetuating the misconception that today's land-bound geographies have existed forever.
The Frayed Atlantic Edge is available now from the RNIB Library as TB704421. It's narrated by Ed Hughes. And David Gange will be back at the end of the show to share the books of his life. You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and exclusive author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, Mick Dawson on rowing across the Pacific Ocean, and Joanna Streetley on the perils of coastal life. But first, on the other side of the Atlantic in 1912, a far larger vessel than a kayak, made history in a dramatic and tragic way. Robert Kirkwood has been trawling the RNIB library for books about the Titanic.
Recently on Talking Books, we played the classic A Night to Remember, a chronicle of the sinking of the Titanic by Walter Lord. It's read by Maurice Turner.
Far foreign, away from the uproar, trimmer Samuel Hemming climbed back into his bunk, satisfied that the hissing sound in the forepeak didn't mean very much. He was just drifting off to sleep when the ship's joiner leaned in, saying, "If I were you, I'd turn out. She's making water, 1, 2, 3, and the racket course getting filled up." An instant later, the bosun appeared. "Turn out, you fellas. You haven't half an hour to live. That's from Mr. Andrews. And keep it to yourselves and let no one know."
Maurice Turner reading from A Night to Remember by Walter Lord. And after listening to that book, I went to the RNIB library to see just how many Titanic books there were. Titanic, A Survivor's Story by Archibald Gracie and read by Jonathan Oliver. A first-hand account of the Titanic disaster, this book records not only the author's own experiences on that fateful night, but those of many other survivors. The author also attended numerous court hearings to obtain the official record.
Monsieur Thayer and Widener must have gone toward the stern during the short interval of my absence. No one at this point had jumped into the sea. If there had been any, both Clinch Smith and I would have known it. After the water struck the bridge forward, there were many who rushed aft, climbed over the rail, and jumped. But I never saw one of them. I was now working with the crew at the davits on the starboard side forward, adjusting them, ready for lowering the Engelhart boat from the roof of the officer's house to the boat deck below. Someone of the crew on the roof, where it was, sang out, "Has any passenger a knife?" I took mine out of my pocket and tossed it to him, saying, "Here is a small penknife, if that will do any good." It appeared to me then that there was more trouble than there ought to have been in removing the canvas cover and cutting the boat loose, and that some means should have been available for doing this without any delay. Meantime, 4 or 5 long oars were placed aslant against the wall of the officer's house to break the fall of the boat, which was pushed from the roof and slipped with a crash down onto the boat deck, smashing several of the oars. Clinch Smith and I scurried out of the way and stood leaning with our backs against the rail, watching this procedure and feeling anxious lest the boat might have been stove in, or otherwise injured so as to cause her to leak in the water. The account of the junior Marconi operator, Harold S. Bride, supplements mine. "I saw a collapsible boat," he said, "near a funnel, and went over to it. 12 men were trying to boost it down to the boat deck. They were having an awful time. It was the last boat left. I looked at it longingly a few minutes, then I gave a hand, and over she went."
Titanic, A Survivor's Story by Archibald Gracie is read by Jonathan Oliver. Clive Cussler's Raise the Titanic. Mightiest of ocean liners, the Titanic lies 2.5 miles down in the North Atlantic, and in her hold, perhaps the only amount anywhere of an incredibly rare substance that could make the free world invulnerable to foreign attack forever. The Americans want it, and so do the Russians. And the sea never gives up its secrets without a struggle, which makes the task facing ace maritime troubleshooter Dirk Pitt one of the most stupendous tests of human courage and ingenuity ever.
Suddenly, in the gloom at the outer edge of the blackness, a rounded object became visible, haloed in the eerie light like an immense tombstone. Soon the three pairs of eyes inside the submersible could distinguish the furnace gratings of the great boiler, and then the row upon row of rivets along the iron seams and the torn, jagged tentacles of what was left of its steam tubing. "How would you like to have been a stoker in those days and fed that baby?" Giordino muttered. "I've picked up another one," Gunn said. "No, wait. The pulse is getting stronger. Here comes the length." 100 feet. 2. Keep coming, sweetheart, Pitt prayed. 507, 800 feet. We got her. We've got her. What course? Pitt's mouth was as dry as sand. Bearing 097, Gunn replied in a whisper. They spoke no more for the next few minutes as the sea slug closed the distance. Their faces were pale and strained with anticipation. Pitt's heart was pounding painfully in his chest, and his stomach felt as if it had a great iron weight in it and a huge hand crushing it from the outside. He became aware that he was allowing the submersible to creep too close to the ooze. He pulled back the controls and kept his eyes trained through the viewport. What would they find? A rusty old hulk, far beyond hope of salvaging? A shattered, broken hull buried to its superstructure in the muck? And then his straining eyes caught sight of a massive shadow looming up ominously in the darkness. "Christ almighty!" Giordino mumbled in awe. "We've struck her fair on the bows!" As the range narrowed to 50 feet, Pitt slowed the motors and turned the sea slug on a parallel course with the ill-fated liner's waterline. The mere size of the wreck when viewed from alongside her steel plates was a staggering sight. Even after nearly 80 years, the sunken ship proved to be surprisingly free of corrosion. The gold band that encompassed the 882-foot black hull glistened under the high-intensity lights. Pitt eased the submersible upward past the 8-ton port side anchor until they could all clearly make out the 3-foot-high golden letters that still proudly proclaimed her as the Titanic.
Raise the Titanic by Clive Cussler is read by Michael Fitzpatrick. Also available are Titanic Lives, The Discovery of the Titanic, The Titanic Disaster, Titanic's Last Secrets, and The Riddle of the Titanic, in which the authors present a reassessment of one of the greatest legends of the 20th century. They show that the discovery of the wreck has raised more problems than it solved. They also bring out other intriguing questions. Why was the man at the helm when she hit the iceberg packed off to South Africa? Why did her chief officer feel uneasy about sailing on her? Why did one of the stewards wish the bally ship at the bottom of the sea? It wasn't only the sea that covered up the Titanic.
A framed notice behind glass in the chart room of every White Star liner drew the attention of officers to a series of principles, the first of which was the vital importance of exercising the utmost caution in navigation, safety outweighing every other consideration, the document's own emphasis. The ship's rules contain the following order. The chief officer is held jointly responsible with the commander for the safe and proper navigation of the steamer, and it shall be his duty to make a respectful representation to the commander if he apprehends danger, when his responsibility shall cease. Any neglect in this respect will not be excused. There is no means of knowing whether Wilde made any representation to Smith. But if he was uneasy before the voyage began, indeed before he joined the ship, one cannot help wondering how he felt when he heard, as he must have done, of the specific ice warnings received as the liner pounded westward. The chief officer, who of course followed his captain in going down with the ship, is a curiously shadowy figure, seldom coming out of the background in the evidence of the two inquiries. But when he is mentioned by witnesses, he emerges as a powerful, calming presence, supervising the loading of the boats while quelling indiscipline and panic by sheer force of personality. Not the kind of man one would think to be overcome by queer feelings before taking up his berth on a ship where he could never previously have worked, the brand new Titanic. From Wilde's letter to his sister, it is absolutely clear that he felt unhappy about the ship before he took up his post, and that his misgivings were not dispelled when he boarded her for the first time, at any rate since she had been officially commissioned on the 2nd of April 1912. Could he have seen or heard something that escaped the attention of others, with the possible exception of John Coffey? The Titanic started work, with a fire burning in her bowels, no binoculars in her crow's nest, no lifeboats for half of those aboard, and an uneasy chief officer dragooned on board against his will on her bridge. He, the first officer, the chief engineer, and a large slice of the rest of the crew were veterans of the Olympic, as, of course, was the captain himself. The latter once again allowed his ship to go too fast in narrow waters, only just evading, thanks mostly to the skill of a tug-skipper, yet another mishap. Although the ship's coal problem was solved at the expense of other vessels, passengers were few, and a significant number cancelled at the 11th hour. The official inspections were perfunctory, and the owner's chief representative held a secret conclave with the chief engineer to plan a speed test, and then kept a vital ice warning in his pocket for 5.5 hours. Neither he, nor the master, nor the officers, nor indeed the generality of the merchant marine, apparently felt any special caution was necessary, although all of them knew, in a general sense, before they set sail, that the great ship was heading for an extremely unusual, not to say unique, concentration of ice in an area where ice should not have been such a hazard on the main Atlantic liner route at that time of year.
The Riddle of the Titanic by Robin Gardner is read by Ronald Markham. A small selection of books about the Titanic disaster, available from RNIB Talking Books. For more information, head to the library, rniblibrary.com, or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
Thanks, Robert. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Still to come in this week's show, Joanna Streatley describes some dangerous moments on the outer coast, and David Gange shares the books of his life. But first, Mick Dawson is not a man to shy away from a challenge. The former Royal Marine Commando holds several Guinness World Records for his rowing achievements, and recently completed the Great Pacific Race with blind veteran Steve Sparks, which was a total of 2,000 miles. But that wasn't Mick's first Pacific adventure. In 2009, he and Chris Martin became the first pair to row across the Pacific Ocean. The 7,000-mile voyage took 3 attempts, during which the two men rowed around the clock and faced continuous peril. His account of this epic adventure is retold in Rowing the Pacific, 7,000 miles from Japan to San Francisco. Here he is talking to Robert Kirkwood.
Well, Mick, it was an incredible journey, 7,000 miles across the North Pacific to San Francisco from Japan. Now, the Pacific sounds like it should be, well, a very peaceful ocean, but we know from your book that it isn't.
The Pacific is probably not the worst, but certainly the least descriptive name of it. Having said that, on occasions it can be just the most placid place, but particularly the North Pacific, you're looking at a huge stretch of water, over 4,500 miles to the US, and it just brings consistent hostile elements to it. We were right the way through, even in the summer, dealing with storms up to 45 knots. And when we were racing into San Francisco towards the end in the winter, we were getting battered by storms that were getting longer, harsher, stronger, colder, and more frequent. Every 2 weeks, we expected to get at least one major low come through throughout. By the time we were getting into San Francisco, they were coming like with a day's break between them. Pacific is definitely not the word that would correctly describe that stretch of ocean most of the time.
And one thing people may wonder is why?
Why? Yeah. You know, when it all started, and I know some people will definitely understand this, maybe some people won't, but when people ask me, why do you want to row across, originally it was the Atlantic, my answer would be, why not? And it was as simple as that. As soon as I found out it was feasible, I couldn't work out why more people weren't doing it. It flicked a switch for me, and it was just the right thing to do. But I have to say, having gone through 10 years of ultimately 5 of different ocean rows, and then sitting down and having to analyse it right in the book, I started to ask myself that question in a bit more depth, and during the book came up with a few more answers. But obviously the part of it is your character and your upbringing and your background, I tried to answer that question more in the book, and probably answered it for myself as much as anything. I started that book thinking, why not? And by the end of it, I'd kind of realised that, you know, there were things in my life that had led me down that path and made rowing, particularly the North Pacific, a requirement.
And how's your relationship with your rowing partner, Chris Martin?
It's amazingly really good. That's why we were successful. We got on. We never argued. We had times when we didn't want to talk to each other and probably were getting on each other's nerves, me more on Chris's nerves than him on mine. But that was the secret. We were a brilliant partnership. I mean, that's what came out of it for me. I'm more proud about the fact that we became that team that achieved what we did than what we actually achieved. It was, you know, it was a, you know, getting to San Francisco was just a natural byproduct of how good we were as a team. So that was a real achievement. But yeah, we're good mates. He's just had his second child. He married his then girlfriend Sandra, and he organises races from rowing races from California to Hawaii now. I'm not allowed to go to the start in case I get on a boat if anybody gets off. So. But we're still good mates. You couldn't do something like that and not have a special bond with somebody.
For people that can't see, can you describe the boat for us?
Absolutely. My first boat, when I was doing the initial Atlantic race with my brother and then the solo Pacific attempt, the boat that I lost was basically a kit. It came in plywood board that we put together, built, and it was like a tank. But the boat that I built for the North Pacific row that Chris and I did was like it was like going from the Sopwith Camel to a jet fighter. It was a phenomenal piece of kit. It was sleek, blue and silver, cabin at the back, small cabin at the front, a rowing deck in the middle. She looked fantastic, and she was built specifically for that job. 50 kilos of lead in the keel, so that she, if she went over, she would definitely come back up. And she was made out of a foam sandwich of Kevlar carbon. So she was light, but incredibly strong. And she looked, it's like looking at Concord in ocean rowing boat terms to your first commercial airliner. That's nothing. I love my first boat, but the Bojangles, the boat that we went across the Pacific on, looked and was the part.
Now, you said if it went over, were there any times it was close to going over?
Strangely enough, we were knocked down twice, as I recall. I was on deck once and we got knocked down. On any other boat, we would have gone over. But she was so good, and that additional weight on the keel and the way we stowed her and her profile, she never went over. She's really rigid. I'm sure some of your listeners will be sailors. You'll know what I mean when I say a stiff boat. She was stiff when the waves hit her, and quite rigid. And she was really resistant to going over, so she never capsized. And you wouldn't believe the conditions we were in at times throughout that trip. But she got knocked over right on her beam end twice, and she still wouldn't go over. She just popped back up again. So, she was and still is the best ocean rowing boat that's ever been built for the job of getting across the North Pacific.
Now, recently on the show, we had someone who is not as big a journey as yours, but they kayaked around Ireland, and they commented on how much wilderness and how much wildlife there was out there. Any close encounters?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a big trip in a kayak around Ireland. That's a bucket list trip for kayakers. I mean, that's really why I went back. The North Pacific was just the most incredible environment for wildlife, and I got... I think when I went across solo and capsized after 109 days, I had encountered, I estimated, about 70 close encounters with all manner of species of whale. And that's from killer whales, pod of killer whales that effectively adopted me. I mean, regularly came to visit me. Sei whales, right whales, fin whales, pilot whales, to even one day paddling along or rowing along next to a blue whale for what must have been nearly an hour. I think it was just drifted in as it was sleeping, but it's just the most, a blue whale doesn't even look like a whale, it's so big, it looks like a different species of animal, but it was just teeming with wildlife on the North Pacific, and so remote, you're so isolated, it's like being on another planet. That was the reason I went back. When I lost the film when I capsized in 2004 on my own, and I wanted to go back and get that story again, which is what Chris and I did.
You must have felt so small next to that whale.
Yeah, well, I'll be honest, the blue whale was surreal. I felt smaller when the killer whales were charging at the boat to come and have a look at me, and slightly more vulnerable. But no, they never. I think I've been at sea something like 420 days in ocean rowing boats on the Atlantic and the Pacific, and everyone talks about whales hitting you. The only contact I've ever made with a whale was on the 2009 trip when three of them came to play with us for about 6 hours, and I managed to row onto the back of one by mistake. And even then, it didn't react violently. It just dropped down and left us alone. But just going out on the ocean, I think, on any boat gives you your place in the universe. You know, any ego disappears straight away. If it doesn't, it should do.
Fantastic. Now, just finally, how do you handle the mundane things like sleep?
It's not mundane. It's the most precious thing on an ocean rowing boat. When we were together all my double rows, we basically did 2 hours on, 2 hours off, round the clock, and we were religious on that. Chris and I worked out that we probably didn't row in 6.5 months at sea for maybe 12 hours when we could have in that whole voyage. That's how relentless we were to keeping that boat moving towards America, because it was a desperate battle to get in time. So it's 2 hours on, 2 hours off, 24 hours a day. The only variation to that was, and service personnel amongst your listeners will know, dog watch, which is 6 to 8. We'd make those 1 hour watches so that you didn't do the same shift every day. You basically reverse the shifts. In fact, one day you'd do 11 hours, the other day you'd do 13. So we came to regard the 11 hour day as our day off. So every other day was a day off.
Now, talking of service personnel, you've done some work with Blind Veterans UK.
Well, I've got some friends at Blind Veterans UK. Yeah, I'm hoping to do some more stuff with them. A couple of guys I serve with, Reggie Perrin, who I joined the Marines with, and Marine Sparks, Marine Sparks, that ex-Marine. He was in my brother's troop in training. I met him the other day, actually, for the first time in years. So, yeah, I'd very much like to. I'm very local. I'm just up the road, so I'd very much like to do more work with them. And I'm hoping, especially with the release of the audio book, that this will be something that can link me with them.
Who's actually reading the audiobook?
Well, this may be quite alarming to people listening to this interview, but me.
Have you done it already?
I did it, yeah. I went up to London. My publisher initially said to me, I'll send you some tapes. And I said, well, no, this is my story. This is a very personal story. It's my story. Until I prove I'm completely incompetent, I want to be the first refusal. And so they gave me 5 days at the studio to get it done, and I got it done in 2.5. So I'm hoping that's a good time. So, it's been released, and it's my narration. So, yeah, it's my story and my words, which I'm really, I hope people enjoy it, but I'm really pleased that I'm able to do that.
Thanks, Robert. Rowing the Pacific, 7,000 miles from Japan to San Francisco, written and narrated by Mick Dawson, is out now in paperback, ebook, and audio. Now, before we return to hear the books of David Gange's life, Joanna Streatley arrived on the west coast of Vancouver Island when she was 19 years old. She soon discovered the pleasures and dangers of living in the wild, adapting to her role as naturalist, guide, and sea kayak instructor. Wild Fierce Life is her memoir of outwitting bears and wolves, swimming in bioluminescence, and outrunning lightning storms. Now the poet laureate of Tofino, Joanna lives just inches above the water in a small floating house moored in the harbour with her partner and her daughter. Her outstanding nature writing and illustrations are inspired daily by the magnificence of her living environment. She spoke to Robert Kirkwood earlier this year at the Boswell Book Festival.
I'm Joanna Streatley, and I'm just over from Canada with my book, Wild Fierce Life, Dangerous Moments on the Outer Coast. So it's a collection of 15 essays. It's about times when things really just went wrong. So a lot of people write about their adventures. These tend to be sort of misadventures when I wasn't really planning to have an adventure that day.
There was a fascinating one involving bioluminescence.
Yes, I do tell a story of being lost at night in the ocean, being distracted, I should say, swimming at night in the ocean, because it's very rare that we get bioluminescence. But if you do dive into the ocean, and It suddenly lights up around you. It's very distracting, and you might swim a little further than you anticipated. And if it just happens that it's a dark moonlit night and the fog comes in and you turn around and you can't see the shoreline anymore, you could have a little bit of misadventure start at that point. Yeah.
You were a sea kayak instructor. Have you ever taught anyone with sight loss?
I have taken people without sight in sea kayaks. One of the great things about sea kayaks is that you do have double kayaks. And so a non-sighted person can sit in a double kayak with a person who has sight. And I've heard that the sensations in the kayak are very lovely, because there is that you can sort of feel the water against the hull. And you can feel the very slight shifting of the boat in the water, and the sounds are very, very soothing as well. So, and that's the nice thing about the double kayaks. I've taken one person who had been terribly afflicted by polio when they were a child, and they were able to come out in the kayak and enjoy the trip as fully as the other participants. It was really, you know, those double kayaks are fantastic for those reasons.
You lived in sort of unique buildings. Tell us about a floating house.
Yeah, so my mum always used to say, oh yeah, you live on a boat. And I would say, no mum, I don't live on a boat. And then she'd say, oh, you know, your boathouse, it must be very damp. And I would say, no, I don't live on a boathouse either. I live on a float house, which over there, I mean, if you imagine a big wooden dock, like you would find down at the yacht club or whatever, and you build a little house on it, then it's a floating house. It's a house that floats, and it's very different from anything with a hull. It's not, does not have a hull. And actually, I have a house on land that I own as well that I don't live in, and that thing has flooded 3 times, and my float house has never flooded, so it's actually not damp. And my mother will probably always say that it is, but it's not. So I lived very remotely, about 25 minutes from the nearest small town by boat, up through a tidal flat area. And a lot of wildlife up there, and very, very, very remote. And of course, it was before the time of too much wind and solar energy. No GPS, no cell phones, no connection, you know, just you and the candles.
Was that what you were after, proper isolation?
No, I wasn't really after isolation. I was actually just after for a safe place to put my house. And at the time, I had been at an island in the harbour, and every storm that came through that winter just about blew the house to shreds. Mm. And one winter, I was just standing there, and a gust came, and it blew through one part of the house. And the next thing I knew, the kitchen windows had blown completely out, and they had disappeared across the bay, and I could see them floating on the far side of the bay. And in the meantime, the house was pulling and creaking, and every single part of the house was pulling a different way, which is very stressful on any kind of building, even though it was a wooden building. And I knew that my house was going to basically break apart if I kept it in that location. So the next calm location that was available was 25 minutes away. And so it was the house or nothing. And so I moved the house.
I loved your description of the lawn outside the house you lived in that didn't move.
Yeah, so if you've lived by the sea, and a lot of people in Scotland can probably relate to this, you know, I mean, many of you probably live right down by the sea. So you get very used to the tide coming in and going out. And it's part of your inner lexicon that your visual map of your world is that when you look out of the window, you see the tide in different stages. But when I had to live somewhere where there was a green lawn, every time I looked out of the window, the lawn was in the same place, and I found it very perplexing. I kept having to do a double take, because I'd look and I'd see the lawn, and I'd say, oh, it's still there. Oh, it hasn't moved. And I'd look over again to make sure that that was true. And then I realized, oh, I think I'm having culture shock.
So you decided the float house was where you wanted to be.
I'm still living there now, and I've been living out in Tofino for 30 years, so I don't have plans to move. However, float houses, you know, there aren't government provisions for float houses. You know, you're always kind of at the whim of somebody that you're paying rent to somewhere, so you never quite know how long you can continue to live in one.
Thanks to Robert and to Joanna Streatley. Wild Fierce Life is out now in paperback and ebook wherever books are sold. Now it's back to David Gange for the books of his life. David, was there a book that as a boy or a young man you fell in love with and made you fall in love with reading and writing?
There were several, but my choice for you today is the Earthsea books by Ursula Le Guin. So this follows a young boy who is a misfit in the world that he's brought up in. The other children around him are all learning forms of magic, kind of ritualized town kind of magic, and that he doesn't have. And it gradually turns out that rather than being unmagical, he has a very different kind of magic. He can communicate with wildlife, with natural creatures. He's much more embedded in the natural world than they are. And it's his discovery of these powers that form the narrative of the journey. So it's, in some ways, it can be read as a kind of celebration of neurodiversity, as a celebration of difference. And Ursula Le Guin, one of the best science fiction and fantasy writers there have been, I think, is someone who, even though it's been 50 years since she wrote this book, still deserves to be read by children today.
The island of Gaunt, a single mountain that lifts its peak a mile above the storm-wrecked northeast sea, is a land famous for wizards. From the towns in its high valleys and the ports on its dark, narrow bays, many a Gauntishman has gone forth to serve the lords of the archipelago in their cities as wizard or mage, or looking for adventure, to wander working magic from isle to isle of all Earthsea. Of these, some say the greatest, and surely the greatest voyager, was the man called Sparrowhawk, who in his day became both dragon lord and archmage. His life is told of in The Deed of Ged and in many songs. But this is a tale of the time before his fame, before the songs were made.
A Wizard of Earthsea by Ursula Le Guin is available in Braille, giant print and as TB3594. It's narrated by Carol Marsh. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
So this would actually, surprisingly, be a science book, but a very, very different kind of science book. So it's another quite old book by the incredible environmentalist and marine biologist Rachel Carson, who wrote the famous book Silent Spring. But her very first book was called Under the Sea Wind. It's such beautiful writing. It's highly experimental. Her argument is that we can't understand the ocean unless we see it or sense it from the perspective of the creatures in it. So she takes a kind of mackerel's perspective on the ocean and seabird's perspectives on the ocean, the perspective of a crab, and tries to work out how they navigate their way around the system, how they interact with other kinds of species. And she writes about them as characters. So each of them has a name, which is usually derived from its Latin name. And you follow these little sea characters around in narrative form and learn about how the ocean works as one massive ecosystem by doing that.
About sunset, the tide had been out. Now it was rising, covering the afternoon resting places of the skimmers, moving through the inlet and flowing up into the marshes. Through most of the night, the skimmers would feed, gliding on slender wings above the water in search of the small fishes that had moved in with the tide to the shelter of grassy shallows. Because they fed on the rising tide, the skimmers were called flood gulls. On the south beach of the island, where water no deeper than a man's hand ran over gently ribbed bottom, Ringkops began to wheel and quarter over the shallows. He flew with a curious, lilting motion, lifting his wings high after the downstroke. His head was bent sharply, so that the long lower bill, shaped like a scissor blade, might cut the water. The blade, or cutwater, plowed a miniature furrow over the placid sheet of the sound, setting up wavelets of its own, and sending vibrations thudding down through the water to rebound from the sandy bottom.
Under the Sea Wind by Rachel Carson is available commercially in print, ebook, and audio, which is narrated by C.M. Hébert. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
So for the project I was doing, poetry was the most important resource I have, partly because of the kinds of ways in which poets often interact with the world, seeing it in detail rather than big pictures, really closely following their senses around coastal areas and things like that. And my favourite book of poetry I've read recently is a fantastic collection from Shetland called Modder Die by someone called Roseanne Watt. So part of it is written in English and part of it is written in the strong Shetland dialect. And it's a wonderful exploration of how those two languages relate to each other, with a wonderful preface about how the language works that brings home lots of things about how humans relate to the sea, about how humans relate to the languages they speak, about how humans and other animals interact with each other. So Roseanne is also a filmmaker as well as a poet, and she goes out into the landscapes that she's writing about with a microphone, records the ambient sounds around her, and reads the poems with those ambient sounds. And you can find online collections of her different poetic renderings of her work in these soundscapes. And I think they're so evocative of different places and different cultures that I recommend them to everyone.
Modder Die by Roseanne Watt is available in paperback and ebook wherever you buy your books. And for an audio version, you can find her on vimeo.com. David Gange, thank you so much for sharing your love of language, of writing, and of reading with the Read On listeners, and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you very much indeed. It's been a pleasure.
Don't forget that you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not subscribe to our podcast? We're available from all the major platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or just search for RNIB Talking Books in your favourite podcast app. If you need any help, have any questions about the show, or just want to keep up to date with us, why not look for us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, that's REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at talking_books. So, farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.